I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of an artist who was clearly born to paint. Joan Snyder's parents weren't the artsy types. They didn't take her to museums or galleries or plays or concerts. She had a paint box, but she made her pictures in the basement and no one paid any attention. It wasn't until Joan's senior year in college that she took an art course and discovered the talent she had. Now, this was 1962, and she has been painting ever since. Some of her work's quite abstract. In some pieces, she'll cut the canvas. On others, she'll use scraps of fabric, dark or discordant colors. She was as surprised as anyone when she was awarded one of the recent MacArthur Genius Grants.
The MacArthur is like the biggest pat on the back you could probably get. And it made me feel so good and say, wow, look at all these incredible paintings you've made. Why do you feel insecure?
Joan Snyder's palette of life and art. My conversation with her is coming up right after the news. I have a piece of advice for you if you're planning to have a conversation with the painter Joan Snyder. Don't try to put a label on the woman or her art. At a recent show, she put up a text describing female sensibility as layers, words, membranes, cotton, cloth, rope, repetition, bodies, wet, opening, closing, repetition, and that goes on. Her artwork ranges from pieces that are just stand-in-your-tracks beautiful to others with gashes and red paint, thick stitches and collages that are clearly meant to shock. Joan Snyder has never tried to fit into any one school of art.
Feminist artist, the expressionist artist, the lyrical abstractionist. I am all of those things, but I'm also just a painter and just in my studio like any other person who's in their studio painting, you know? So the labels are all very silly to me, but if people need to do that, then I don't argue with them.
She doesn't have to. People have been collecting Joan Snyder's artwork now for 40 years. What they're drawn to is her talent. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
I'd suspect that if you went through most of Joan Snyder's paintings, you'd find that each one has a story, some attachment to a time in her life, perhaps when she was enjoying the warmth of a summer sun at her farm in Woodstock, New York. Joan herself will agree that there's a measure of autobiography in almost everything she does. Joan tells one story about a particularly evocative painting called Cherry Tree. It's a big piece, 4.5 feet by 5.5 feet, golden in color. The tree itself is nearly bare. There are small bits of silk and straw embedded in the paint.
The story behind that one is that my father, who was 92 at the time, was in a nursing home on Fort Hamilton Parkway in Brooklyn. And if anybody knows anything about Brooklyn or Fort Hamilton Parkway, it's a very unattractive...
Bleak is the word that I would use, just kind of very urban.
Bleak is the best word I could think of. I don't want to insult anybody, which is why I wasn't going to say something else, but bleak is a good word. I was driving down Fort Hamilton Parkway on the way to visit my father, who we call Pop, and I suddenly saw a tiny little house with a small yard, and there was a cherry tree in the yard. I slowed the car down and noticed that the cherry tree was full of cherries. You know, it was in late August, early September. And I stopped the car, looked at the cherry tree, and on the ground were lots of rotting cherries. Suddenly I got really excited about this because I could immediately see that this was a metaphor for life and death. And I, in fact, was on the way to see my father, who was probably approaching death. I rang the bell and asked the woman if I had a camera, if I could take some pictures of her cherry tree. And in fact, I still have pictures of this cherry tree. The interesting thing about it was that she had all these little red flags in the cherry tree, and it was probably to keep birds away or something.
Keep them away from her cherries.
It had so many different icons and metaphor of life and death. Cherries falling off the tree. This painting has a piece of silk going down the middle, and it sort of became an altar. Some of the little cherries are sitting on pieces of silk, and that makes them stand out more. The bottom has straw and different herbs in it, and so it looks very, you know, very earthy, and there's rotting cherries on the bottom of the painting.
Were you thinking at the time, Joan, this is going to be an amazing painting, or were you just really sort of more captured by the image itself and, you know, knowing that you were going off to see your dad who wasn't well and stuff like that? Or did you know it was a painting right then?
I knew it was something that I could probably use and that it was going to be a painting. I mean, I didn't know it was going to be an amazing painting, but I certainly knew that this was something that was going to be important to me.
When I talk with an artist, I almost always ask how their talent is nurtured. What happened in childhood that set the scene for this kind of success? Joan Snyder's answer to that question was, not much.
We never went to museums. We never went to concerts. We never, you know, a lot of these things are free. So it's not as if I could say they didn't do it because they couldn't afford it. It's just that they weren't thinking that way, you know. It just wasn't part of their life or their thought or their, you know, what they thought that they should give their children or do for their children. So there was absolutely no exposure to any kind of a cultural life in growing up in my family. And in fact, even I think by the time I got to college, I probably had never been to a museum. But, you know, I remember my mother playing some music, and I remember her saying, this is Beethoven. She pronounced the TH, but at least she played it, you know. But there really wasn't any exposure, which is why I think when I started painting that it was pretty raw and with this desperate need to express myself, because I really felt that I had been anxious for so many years of my life that this was a way that I was going to be able to speak.
You didn't set out to study art, did you? I mean, you were in college studying something else.
I was studying sociology. And when I became a senior in college, I suddenly, I don't know, it just occurred to me that I felt like painting. And I got into a painting course, making still lifes and nothing very interesting. But then I decided to make paintings of people that were important in my life. So I was making a painting at the time. It was probably the first portrait painting that I did of my brother and sister-in-law. And it was kind of an expressionistic painting. My brother had a pipe in his mouth, and it was two heads coming out of a body, and there were different colors, earth colors and things like that. And my teacher looked at it and said, "How do you like Yavolensky?" And I said, "Who's Yavolensky?" And he dragged me up to the slide room, and he showed me slides of German and Russian expressionist paintings. And I think that that was the turning moment in my life, was him showing me those paintings, because one of the paintings looked very much like what I was painting, actually, and with the same colors and this man with a pipe in his mouth, I think. I do come from Russian-German descent, and these German and Russian expressionists were exactly what I needed to see at the moment. It opened up a world to me that I didn't know.
Did it change your mind about what you were doing? Did it make you think, hey, maybe I'm really good at this, rather than just, you know, being a college student and putting paint on a canvas?
I didn't think maybe I'm really good at this. I thought I will be good at this. You know, this is something that I think I will be very good at. At the time, I wasn't good at it. You know, I was just a young painter.
Are you the one who made the decision, you know, I'm going to stay with this? What happened next?
I think that I'm the one that made the decision. Instead of pursuing a career as a sociologist, I did decide to take a year off. I don't know how I knew this or how I was brave enough to do this, but I did rent myself a studio on the water. It was a wonderful, beautiful place, small place, and I started painting.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Joan Snyder started painting, but like so many artists, her work was forever being interrupted by the part-time job she needed to get by, so she decided to see if she could go back to school. She aimed high, the MFA program at Rutgers.
I piled my paintings into my car, and I drove over to the Rutgers Art Department, knocked on the head of the department's door. I probably made an appointment, unloaded my car, and showed him all my paintings. He said, "Well, I'll let you come for a year non-matriculated, and we'll see how you do. And then if you do well enough, I'll put you in the program." And that's exactly what happened.
This was your sort of informal application to a Master of Fine Arts?
Exactly. I got in.
And so here you are with this, clearly some natural ability, and now you're studying art. Did the two ever contradict each other, Joan, where you knew what you wanted to do and someone was saying, "No, that's not the right technique. Try it this way"?
Well, that did happen. I was pretty strong-headed about the fact that I knew that I had to basically send myself through this program. So I would give myself assignments. I would tell myself, you know, this month you're going to make a painting with one figure. This month you're going to make a painting with two figures. You know, now you're going to concentrate on color. Now you, because most of my fellow students had been to art school and had many years of rigorous training. I had never taken a drawing course. I applied my own kind of discipline. I had teachers who didn't get me at all. One of my painting teachers was much too sophisticated for me. He would come into the studio and say, you know, do three more of those. And that wasn't interesting to me. Basically, he didn't know what to do with me. I had a sculptor teacher who was Robert Morris. He was one of the leading minimalists at the time. And most of the students in the class were making square boxes or cubes painted gray because that's what Bob Morris would have them do and would want them to do. I, on the other hand, was making an angel. The torso was built out of plaster. It had plywood pink legs. It had plastic flowers on the plywood base. It had red fringe around its waist. It had big plywood cutout wings. It drove Robert Morris crazy because he was a minimalist, you know.
Take more away, and you're saying, no, put more on.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, I wanted more, not less in my work. I mean, I was interested in content and storytelling and narrative, and they were into some very sophisticated idea of minimalism. And I honestly probably didn't even get it, didn't even know what they were talking about. But I knew it wasn't for me. He looked at the piece when it was done, and he said, well, that's something I would like to put in my attic and go visit it once every 10 years to make sure it's still there. You know, something like that. He wasn't, you know, mean or nasty. But
that's fairly just, mean and nasty.
Well, you know, that's sarcastic. I think he was amused by me.
Joan Snyder got early notice for her grad school work, but she gathered much wider attention for a series of abstract pieces that came after called her stroke paintings.
It was a good thing for several years, and then it got to be too much. Different things were happening, one of which was that I didn't really want to do the stroke paintings anymore, and there was a waiting list for the stroke paintings. And, of course, people loved the stroke paintings, and I was ready to move on to something else. And I had been getting lots of exposure and really began to feel like I was collecting people like you collect butterflies. You know, you just don't know who your friends are and who your friends aren't at that point.
Like any creative person, Joan Snyder is forever in search of inspiration, of new challenges. She finds it in music. She finds it in her own stories about the end of her marriage, the growth of her daughter, the relationship with her companion Maggie. I'll talk more with her about how it all changes her art in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Joan Snyder is a painter who is one of the most recent winners of a MacArthur Genius Grant. The announcement came along with a description of her, quote, fiercely individualistic approach and her abstract paintings that defy categorization. Sounded to me like someone well worth talking to. In the 1970s, Joan decided to shift away from the familiarity of what she'd been doing. She began using dark, earth-colored paint to cover up other colors in her work. I asked her about one painting called The Storm. In this one, the canvas is divided into 18 squares. Each square looks like there's something under the dark paint.
Underneath all those different beautiful colors of mud is a very bright, colorful painting that I was covering up because I was feeling very vulnerable. You know, I didn't want to expose myself anymore.
Joan says she moved with her husband out of the city, and the art began to reflect a change in her own awareness of feminism.
We moved to the farm, and I started making paintings that were completely different than the stroke paintings. I mean, they were what I call now kind of very strongly feminist paintings, female imagery. It was not figurative. It was more expressionist. For example, Vanishing Theater.
Vanishing Theater is the one where you've actually cut the canvas?
I've actually cut the canvas. Cut it, stuffed it with chicken wire first, mattress batting, and then sewed it up. And you can see the sewing on the canvas.
And this is a big piece. This is, what, 5 feet by 10 feet? Is that right?
5 by 12.
5 by 12.
It's very big.
And scribbled up in the corner, "Take your clothes off, lady, and let's see who you really are." Was this an angry time for you?
I don't know if you'd say it was an angry time, I suppose. It was really directed towards one person. It was about someone who was in my life, who I didn't want in my life anymore. Part two of the painting says, "Vanishing Theater, the Cut." And the words "Vanishing Theater" come from a section of a George Eliot novel, Middlemarch. And in it, she talks about losing someone very important in her life. And she says, "The theater of all my ideas has vanished." That's how I felt, that, you know, someone had vanished from my life who was important to my life, or maybe I wanted them to vanish from my life. And it was about The Emperor Has No Clothes. It was about someone I was idolizing and really didn't deserve it at that point. So I guess you could say it was an angry painting. But, you know, there's also fake fur in that painting, so that's sort of a funny thing. You know, it can be very angry, but it can also go off in other directions. I like the idea of making a painting that might have many different feelings or ideas or emotions in it. I'm very connected to music, and I love the idea. I always wanted to make paintings that were, for example, like a symphony, and I still do, that might have a sad part, a joyous part, a beginning, a middle, an end, resolute. It always has to have some sort of resolution in it. I've actually been to small concerts, and the musicians look at me and think that I'm the critic in the second row making, you know, writing. But what I'm really doing is making lots of sketches for painting ideas, because I go into another zone, I think, and I really relax, and the music affects my thoughts about new work, and I make lots of sketches and come up with different painting ideas just from listening to the music. And if you were looking over my shoulder, I'd be writing on the playbill most likely, or looking for blank spaces on the playbill, or rifling through my purse for little pieces of paper that I could draw on and things like that.
And are those moments that actually produce pieces of art that end up being significant paintings?
They are, and they do, yeah. They definitely do.
Have you figured out that connection between music and art, or why it is music can be such a trigger for you in producing ideas for paintings?
Oh, just because some of it's so brilliant, you know. I mean, it's just so multifaceted, and there's music, and there's voice, and there's lots of instruments, and it's very rich.
So you'll play the music while you're painting as well?
I play music while I'm painting, and sometimes I will play a piece of music over and over and over again. Like this past summer, I played the same piece of music almost incessantly. It happens to be, at that point, feeding the body of work I'm working on.
Yeah, I was wondering, if I were then standing behind you in the studio, would I watch you applying paint to the canvas like a maestro with his stick? Do you work that way?
It's all on my feet, and I'm running back and forth. I guess I'm a maestro at the canvas. I don't know. I'm not wielding a baton or anything, but, you know, it's very physical. And then I sit down, and then I look, and then I stand up, and then I run around, and I make notes and look at my sketches, and so it's pretty active.
In the 1990s, Joan, there was a period of time when you went through some pretty significant personal loss, and people around you did as well. That's when both of your parents died?
Both of my parents died, and both of my partner's parents died within 4 years. It was a significant time for both of us to have lost four parents. Suddenly, I realized that there was no color in my paintings. You know, it took me a couple of years to realize that.
That song Joan Snyder was listening to this past summer is Anne-Sophie von Otter's Les Nuits d'été. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Joan was telling me earlier about the connection between the last days of her father and her painting of the cherry tree. I asked Joan how she reacted to the passing of her mother with her art.
I didn't know what to expect because my mother and I had not an easy relationship. But when she died, I think that what happened to me was all the armor went away because I really did love my mother. And when she died, I went into a serious state of mourning for about a year. And I remember that every single day in my studio, I played Mozart's Great Mass. Every single day, and I cried my heart out every day for a year while that music was playing. You know, and then the music went off and I went about my life and my work.
Joan, I'm curious to know how your mother regarded your success as an artist.
I think that when I became known, they took a lot of pleasure in my success. They were very excited about it. You know, I think when my mother died, well, you know, I really did love my mother. What can I say? And she was always very angry, and, you know, we could never talk about things. I was a really sensitive kid, and I used to cry a lot when I was little, and everyone made fun of me, and they called me the waterworks, you know. And she was probably so busy dealing with her own anger and her own frustration that she wasn't able to deal with me with my anxiety. I mean, she wasn't able to, you know, raise me as a kid who understood why I was suffering the way I was suffering. It just wasn't part of her ability to do.
When you look back at the pieces that you've done that are connected to moments in your life, you know, when you moved out to the farm and said enough of the stroke paintings, when your parents and your partner's parents died, there's something really powerful that connects those events in your life to the art that you're producing at the time. Do there have to be powerful moments in your life to trigger good pieces of art? Or is that just you?
I don't think there have to be moments that trigger good pieces of art, but I think moments have certainly triggered pieces of art. I mean, when my daughter was born, I had vowed not to work for many, many months after she was born, and very quickly after she was born, I found myself making a painting called Welcome to This World, Molly Fink. So the work is connected to my life in a pretty important way. But sometimes you don't really realize that. When I made one of my first stroke paintings that I thought was the most important painting I had ever made, I remember the painting had a great deal of order in it and a great deal of structure, and it was what I had been leading up to for years. And it only was later that I realized that I did that painting a few months before I got married. And getting married really meant putting some order and some structure and something into my life that would hold it together and in a way that it hadn't been held together before. So sometimes the paintings can precede what might happen, and other times they follow it.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm talking with the painter, Joan Snyder. This past year, she was one of those chosen as a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Funny thing was, when she got the call, she stopped painting.
I actually had been in this incredible, meditative, fabulous zone of work that's all summer and all fall in my studio. And when I got the news, what do you do? You know, I don't think I was able to go back in the studio and work on the same thing. I went back into the studio and I did some things that were more, you know, kind of fun to do. You know, I made a pumpkin field painting and I...
What was the piece that was in process at the time?
It was a very serene piece that I absolutely love, and it was, you know, full of different colors and with sparkles and poured paint, and I don't know, it was something I was really loving doing, and then I got the news about the MacArthur. I finished a few of those pieces and then kind of stopped working for a month or so.
I like the fact that the MacArthur awarded to you as an artist actually ends up causing you to pause in your creative art.
It really caused me to pause. I think that's really what happened. It wouldn't surprise me if that's what happened to other people too, because you're in such shock. The MacArthur is like the biggest pat on the back you could probably get, and it made me feel so good and say, wow, look at all these incredible paintings you've made. Why do you feel insecure? Well, I think that's just who I am. You know, I think that's probably who I'll always be.
Help me with one other thing, though. When I talk to people who've won the MacArthur Genius Grants, I'm often talking to people who are early in their careers, and they sort of get the acknowledgement and the recognition and the promise of the money over a period of years to come as a way to say, yeah, whatever you're working on is good. Here's a little bit to help you stay on. And in your case, Joan, you're already established. You are a successful artist. And it is, as you say, it is a validation of your art by all means. But it must be a little bit different for you than, you know, some 27-year-old playwright who goes, gee, you know, where am I going to go now?
I honestly, between you and me and everybody who's listening, I actually think it's dangerous to give major, major awards to somebody who's 27. I would never do that. I hope nobody who's 27 got one. You know, I always worry about kids in graduate school who suddenly start making it, getting reputations, because you have so many years that you really have to put in order to have your own voice, to say what you need to say and to dig deep and get someplace that is originally yours.
But Joan, people were singing your praises 2 or 3 years out of graduate school. Your art was selling. You were getting known that early in your life.
It did affect me.
Oh, you mean in a bad way? It kind of threw you off.
It threw me off. I mean, that's why I went to the farm in 1974 and fell apart and started covering paintings over, and then I started making the feminist paintings because it did throw me off. Fortunately, I had a refuge. I mean, I was able to go there and do that. But I do think it can throw somebody off. Even at my age, you know, I say, okay, where do I go from here? You know, I got this incredible honor. And then I have to just go back into my own head and my own place and my own discipline and say, okay, keep working. Forget about it. You were on this path. You were doing X. You have to keep doing X and keep plugging away and keep working at that. Otherwise, what do you do? I mean, you start going to cocktail parties and singing your own praises, and you know, you forget where you are, who you are, and what you were doing. I mean, I am happiest when I'm in the studio working, and that's when I feel the best. That's when I feel like I'm thriving, is when I'm in my studio working.
You and your music.
Me and my music, yeah, exactly.
Painter Joan Snyder divides her time between her studios in Brooklyn and Woodstock, New York. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Coming up next, another story of a woman's willingness to reach. This time for the stars, the astronomer Maggie Turnbull.
People who want to study space, this is something that you don't go into it because you want to get rich or because you even want to get famous, but because you love the sky, because you love the universe. And, you know, when you point a telescope at a star, you're getting everything that's in between you and that star and everything that's behind that star. So you're really piercing a line of sight out into the universe that includes that target that you're really interested in. And I think everybody realizes that although it may be a long shot that somebody else is out there, it would be the kind of event that all of us dreamt about.
I'll talk with Maggie Turnbull about not just her love for space, but her determination to pursue the idea of contact with life out there. That's just ahead. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. You probably heard yesterday that the U.S. government shot down one of its own satellites. I always pay attention to stories like that when I think all the stuff that happens out in space, good and bad, forces me to stretch my imagination. It's also what drew me to talk with a scientist who thinks that there's a chance other planets like Earth could exist somewhere out there. If you think this is beginning to sound more like a science fiction movie that you're familiar with, you're right. The sound of interplanetary radio waves from the film Contact are about as familiar as the doom-doom, doom-doom from the shark film Jaws. There is something about that pulsing sound, signaling life out there.
I got it, I'm patched in.
All right, let me hear it. Listen to that.
It could be AWACS out of Kirtland jamming us, but I'm doubting it.
Willie, patch it back and give me the off axis. Are we recording?
Never stopped.
Okay, point source confirmed. Whatever it is, it ain't local.
The actor who plays the lead astronomer in Contact is Jodie Foster, but the character is actually based on Jill Tarter. She's an astronomer who works at the SETI Institute in California. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Back when the film came out, Maggie Turnbull was studying astronomy in college, and she hadn't given much thought to a serious search for life out there.
I think I expected it to be kind of silly and cheesy. I had pretty low expectations because although I love science fiction and I love science fiction films, sometimes they don't seem to kind of live up to Academy Award standards. And I wasn't really expecting that much when I went. I was very pleasantly surprised with the entire film.
Was there a moment in the film when you went, that's exactly what I want to be doing?
I think that I was just so enthralled with the story throughout the whole movie that it was really at the end when the credits started rolling that I thought, that is what I am going to do. That is what I am supposed to do. It was just so clear that that was, of all the things in astronomy, I always knew that I wanted to go into astronomy. I always loved space, but of all the things that a person could possibly do or discover in astronomy, that was the one thing that I thought would change the world.
Now, you were already well along in your academic career, and this notion that there were, you know, real scientists looking for life out there was just on the periphery of your consciousness. Is that because it was regarded in a kind of skeptical, almost, you know, not real science way? I mean, when you talk to your own colleagues about it, were they in any way cynical or skeptical?
I have to admit, I was pretty clueless. I wasn't really aware of the history of SETI, that Congress had actually passed a law saying that it was not allowed, it was not legal for federal money to go to SETI.
SETI being the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Exactly. Yeah. But I had actually before that written a little essay as part of an astronomy class where I was writing a letter to a congressperson, a theoretical congressperson, trying to persuade them that they should continue to fund the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I had already written that. So one would think that when I saw the movie, I would have known something about this action that Congress had taken or just the general attitude of scientists or the public towards SETI. But I actually ended up meeting people who do SETI. That's when I started getting the feedback that maybe SETI was not considered real science or real astronomy.
How harsh were they on you? I mean, were there people who said, Maggie, don't do this. You're a respected scientist. You don't want to be over in that field.
I think there was a sense that I had a lot of potential and that I should definitely not squander it on pipe dreams. But at the same time, you know, I think people who go into astronomy, people who want to study space, this is something that you don't go into it because you want to get rich or because you even want to get famous, but because you love the sky, because you love the universe. And I think everybody realizes that although it may be a long shot, if SETI were to succeed, it would be the kind of event that all of us dreamt about.
Maggie Turnbull works with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. That organization announced yesterday that it's expanding its hunt for life out there. But that work isn't necessarily prized throughout the scientific community. So I asked Maggie if she ever got the, you know, what's a scientist like you doing in a project like SETI response from other scientists.
Yes, there. I could definitely feel, and people don't always say what they're thinking, but you know anyway what they're thinking. And
see it in their eyes.
The one criticism that kind of haunted me the most was that some people don't believe that SETI is even science at all. Like, just according to the definition of science, you know, you should have a testable hypothesis,
right,
and it should be able to be disproved. Whereas with SETI, it's very nearly impossible to disprove this hypothesis that somebody else is out there, because if you don't discover anything, that just means you haven't looked hard enough. It doesn't mean they're not there.
Did you spend a lot of time figuring out where your place in this research could be?
Yep. It started very small. When I went to work with Jill Tarter, who was kind enough to let me come to the SETI Institute.
Jill Tarter is the woman after whom the character Jodie Foster is modeled in the movie Contact. Right.
Okay. Which I did not realize at the time.
No way.
Even as I was working in her office, I'm telling you, I was the absolute most clueless person, SETI in love with person ever.
So how did you find that out?
I showed up and was working in Jill's office, and she gave me this seemingly small assignment. And I was identifying all these questions and things that really needed to be worked out to do it right. And Jill was off at a bioastronomy conference, which I just thought the very idea of a bioastronomy conference was fascinating. And I was feeling, I will admit, a little bit resentful that I wasn't there, that I was left behind.
Right.
And I had all these really important questions and had to talk to all these important people about this. And I was sitting there a little bit frustrated and just feeling like the task was kind of overwhelming. And all of a sudden I looked over, and sitting right on my desk was a picture of Jill Tarter and Jodie Foster standing in front of the Arecibo dish. And I got up and I went into the office where Jill's assistant works. And I asked her, "Chris, what is this picture from?" And that's when I learned that Jodie Foster actually spent a few weeks with Jill, learning what Jill is like, modeling the character after her persona, and trying to just absorb what is a female scientist like, mm-hmm. what is a strong female scientific leader like. That just completely bowled me over.
I was going to say, at that point, you went, "Oh, I really do want to be here, and I'm not going to whine about not being in Hawaii," right?
Exactly. All the whining stopped, and I got back to work.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Maggie Turnbull's work searching for signs of intelligent life is obviously a calling for her. But I wanted to know from Maggie how, if you're looking for life forms that are not like life forms on Earth, well, how would she know what she's actually looking for?
This work is so uncertain because the only thing we know about life in the entire universe is right here on this planet. But what we're looking for with SETI is something that's like us. In our case, we know that all life depends on water.
So you're looking for the closest approximation to Earth, a planet, or a
right.
star that would have a planet like ours somewhere nearby, right?
Right. You know, there are actually, it kind of opened my mind a little bit because I realized in going through this that there are a lot of different kinds of stellar systems out there where life like ours could be possible. There's a long list of
binary. Okay, but how many are we down to, though? I mean, how short is the list?
Well, I started with a list of 120,000 stars. And from that, I was able to do this kind of research, and in the end, after throwing away all of these bad systems or potentially bad systems, I ended up with a list of 17,000 stars, which sounds like still a lot, and it is. But we have to start somewhere, and we have such little information to go on, but we have information to go on. We do have a little. You know, when you point a telescope at a star, you're getting everything that's in between you and that star and everything that's behind that star. So you're really piercing a line of sight out into the universe that includes that target that you're really interested in, but captures everything else in the line of sight as well. So it's not completely limited just only to that star when we make an observation. And I do take some comfort in that, actually.
Now, my imagination is kind of either guided or limited by everyone else's notion of what extraterrestrials will look like. Everything from the movie E.T. to the characters in Men in Black to the imagination of the people who did the Star Trek series. What are the images that come into your mind about what you might see?
I've tried to think outside the Earth box when it comes to life. But I have to say that when I saw the movie Contact, I was kind of disappointed at the end when they didn't show the aliens. But in retrospect, I'm so glad they didn't, because
right.
it just leaves it open. And I think I do well in that realm of having things be open, mm-hmm. open questions, unanswered questions. And I think of my stars as places where I would want to live. So I think of them as potential homes away from home, more in terms of us than in terms of some imaginary creature that might or might not exist.
And where do you come down on the long-held theory that space creatures have come to this planet and they've all been squirreled away in a secret government lab so we won't go crazy. Do you lend right. anything to that at all?
Well, I... No, I the short answer is no, I don't buy it. But the longer answer is that I've always thought that something about that notion just didn't really jive with me. And other than, you know, the fact that I've never seen anything in my entire life or all of my experience to suggest that aliens have visited Earth, other than that, I have to say that moving to D.C., has clarified some things for me about the federal government and about its
aliens are running the government
and about the federal government's ability to keep secrets. And
oh, I've got you.
Just the very notion that something like that could ever be tied up, you know, in, somewhere in some secret government room and. And
they just never be
never
able
escape.
To keep the secret, is what you're
There's
saying.
There's just no way. I think a leak is the easiest thing to propagate in Washington.
Maggie Turnbull is an astronomer. Her specialty is something called astrobiology. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. I asked Maggie if there's a plan in place. I don't know, just in case something's found. A hotline? Something?
We always make sure that, first of all, there's a bottle of champagne in the fridge. And that's step zero. And second of all, if something interesting happens, everybody knows about it in real time. And there are a number of hoops that they jump through with the telescope when they get an interesting signal just to make sure mm-hmm. that it's not interference from a cell phone or something like that. And they do call other observers and ask them to tune in as well. But if a signal were to be confirmed, then... The plan is to tell everybody. There's no first call this congressperson or go to the president or anything like that.
Right.
We don't ask permission. We publish it instantly. So there's an open book policy.
Tell me something. All the people who you work with in the office, if you were to canvass them and ask the question, mm-hmm. do you believe that there is life out there? You know, you're scientists and... You're searching for this life, but in order to commit the time and effort that you have to that, I have to believe that you're pretty convinced that there's something there, and it's just a matter of either finding a means to locate it or to communicate with it. Am I guessing right here?
Maybe. That might be right. I wonder, actually, what the answers would be. I think a lot of people, a lot of scientists, believe that it's entirely possible that Mars... or Jupiter's moon Europa could have simple organisms living on them. When you start to specify complex animals
right.
or intelligent life, then I think people pause because the history of life on our own planet, it seems that it didn't really necessarily have to lead to anything technological. And so the question of whether there happen to be other technological civilizations out there right now is very uncertain, I think, for most people,
right,
including myself.
I was going to say, though, it's enough to get you into the office each day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, well, if you're going to do something in astronomy, if you're going to look for something cool, make it be the coolest thing you can think of. And then try really hard to do everything you can to find it. Not just half-hearted,
yeah.
but really do it. Make it meaningful.
Well, add our telephone number to your list of people to contact when you see something.
I will do that.
It's a cool job that you have. I'm glad you took some time to talk to us about it.
Thank you. It was fun.
Maggie Turnbull is an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. If you'd like to read more about Maggie and her work, go to our website. We're at thestory.org. You'll find more information there about the search for habitable worlds. Our world here at The Story is populated by producers Anita Woodley, Denise Schreiner, and Corey Princell. Jeanette Arrowwood is our researcher. Engineering work this week by Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar. Rachel McCarthy, Nick Bedinsky, and Jennifer Nathan share our audio editing duties. Chris Carmichael has been working here as one of our interns. This is his last week, and Those of us here at The Story wish him well. The managing editor and director of The Story is Carol Jackson. The senior producer here is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.